Okay, so I'm starting today. So good morning. It's the 6th of Shvat, January 30th, and we are doing Sefer HaChinuch. We had a long introduction not on the tape, so this will be shorter today. We're going to start at Mitzvah 237, but I first want to start with an introduction on the concepts of the rise of the feminine energy that we're experiencing today and some of the roots of that. So there is a midrash, and we're just going to go quickly on this, not in depth at all, but it would be nice to go into this in depth at some point. There's a midrash based on the verses in creation where it discusses the creation of the two great lights. So in the first few days of creation, I think it's on the third day where the sun is created. So it says there were two great lights, the lesser one to rule the night and the greater one to rule the day. So that's what the verse says. So the midrash is right in between those two phrases and says, what do you mean? You said two great lights, and now you're saying there's a lesser one and a greater one? I thought it was two great ones. So there's a whole story in there. So this is the story. So the moon and the sun were both the same size. And the sun comes to, the moon comes to Hashem and says, how can two kings wear one crown? Meaning, how can we both be called great? So Hashem says to the moon, you're right. Go make yourself smaller. So the moon says, what do you mean, make myself smaller? I'm the one that's right. That's not really fair. And I want to be the same size as the sun. So Hashem says, oh, you're right. It's not really fair. So therefore, as a consolation prize, I will give you all the stars in the heaven. They'll be yours. You'll be able to light up the night with that. That light will add into yours. And the moon says, no, that's actually not what I'm looking for. What I would like to be is the same size, right? So Hashem says, oh, you're right. Okay, so you're smaller. You're the katan. I will call you katan like many of the katanim who were great in history, like Shmuel HaKatan was really Shmuel the Great, but he was called Shmuel the Small. So you'll be listed among the katans who were actually great. And she says, nice, but I'm not looking for a title. What I'm looking for is the same. I would like to be the same. So Hashem says, okay, then what I'll do, there's two other things, and I forgot that this thing is. Anyway, in the end, Hashem says, okay, I'll bring a korban. Oh, what appeases it is I'll have the Jews count time by you. You will sanctify the time. You'll be the one. It won't be the sun. They won't count by the years. They'll count by the moons, which we do, by the months. Okay, so that helps. She's quieted by that, but not completely consoled. And so then Hashem says, I'll bring a korban. I'll bring an offering to you. Hashem says, I will bring an offering to you, the moon, every month to make up for the fact that I caused you to be diminished, which doesn't work in terms of how we understand tshuva, because if you want to do tshuva, you first have to right the wrong that you did and then appease the person. Right. So he's not righting the wrong. But the whole end of it is that the end of the midrash, and again, midrashim, we have to remember we don't take them literally, but we do understand important concepts from them. It is a story, but so you don't have to understand the sun and the moon and God talking, but these concepts. What comes out of the whole thing is that the end of the midrash is that Hashem promises that in the end of days he will restore the moon to its former greatness. So what we get from this whole thing is that the moon is the feminine and the sun is the masculine, and that even though the masculine and the feminine were created co-equal, there's a diminishment of the feminine energy that it's temporary, but lengthy. And in the end of days, the feminine energy will be restored to its parallel greatness. And so we do, at this stage in history, which is getting close to the end of days, see a rise in the feminine energy. We see a resurgence in the feminine energy, a rise in that, a change in the way the feminine energy works in the world altogether, the way women work in the world, and the way the feminine energy works in the world. So we see a shift in that. We see negative parts and we see positive parts. So there's this whole book called either The Moon's Lost Light or The Lost Light of the Moon. I always forget what it's called, but it's one of those two by Deborah Heschlis. It is on my website. I have in my resources tab a list of books that I've mentioned in classes, so that if people want to look that up.
Deborah
Heschlis. Her husband's name is Heshy. That's her pen name. Deborah Heschlis. It's quite an amazing book written by a Hasidish woman with 14 children who always had questions, and it's very Kabbalistic, but it has good haskamas on the back of it, good approbation, so you know it's real Torah. anyway, it's fascinating to see. So she talks about one concept that she discusses in the book is how things can come from sources of tuma or sources of tahara, right? That there are different sources for things happening. And of course, if something is sourced in a negative energy, it can't come to a positive fruition. So one example that she gives of that is, in the end of days, we should all be equal, which is one of the secrets of us dancing in a circle. Circle, Jews dance in circles because a circle is where every point is equidistant from the center. So we're supposed to be all equidistant from Hashem. We are not in that stage right now. We have a Kohen Levi Yisrael structure, so we do have a hierarchy within the Jewish people. If you're online and you see a Kohen, you're supposed to let the Kohen go in front. We do show deference to Kohenim. I'm not sure how Leviim work, but for sure for Kohenim, we're supposed to show them deference. So they get to bench first, they get the first Aliyah. So it's not much in the world today, but we are supposed to show them deference. But it's supposed to be that we should all be equal. So in the end of days, there will be that restoration of equality. Also, there won't be this hierarchy. So there is a desire for that equality that's bubbling up in humanity today. We didn't have that before. Everybody was, except for the serfs, everybody was happy with the serf system, right? That across the world, there should be people in charge and people who were shmatas underneath. Right, but now in the general consciousness, there is a sense of fairness, and there should be equality of distribution of. It really should be that everybody works according to their ability, and everybody gets according to their needs. Right, so we tried a system like that in this world, and it didn't work. That's because it came from kochot hatuma, not kochot hatahara.
So the concept is okay, the application and implementation was faulty.
The concept is good that there should be equality, but yes, how the energy from which it, the source from which it drew its energy was a contaminated source, which meant that for sure it couldn't work out properly. But it will, and I think the same thing within, and I don't want to, you know, besmirch an entire movement, but certainly strains within feminism also came from non-kosher places. The fact that women should have a right voice and should be respected, that is absolutely correct. The way some of it came from a negative energy, and so that did create some harm in families and harm in society with the feminine energy not being respected, because part of the feminist movement was to disrespect the feminine energy, right, by saying women can be, women are as good as men because women can be men as well as men can be men.
The unisex to right.
Right, so, and we're just getting to the point now. I think John Gray was a turning point in our evolution, but just in his publishing, Men Are From Mars and Women Are From Venus, mm-hmm, right, in understanding that it's okay, right, we're different, first of all, because we spent, so my whole childhood was the same, right? I mean, that's what was taught. So that we're different and that it's okay, and now we're getting to a place of being able to explore those differences and see what contribution the feminine has, not just tolerating it, and not even just understanding it in terms of relationships and how to make them work, but that there actually might be something really good there that we want, right, and how to get that. Anyway, so that's about that midrash and the rise of the feminine energy. And with that, let us begin our Sefer HaChinuch. And we probably won't do all four today. But I do want to look at these a little bit past what we have on our sheet so far, just because they are of a piece. So not to stand idly by when someone's blood is shed. Okay, so that's not of the piece really of it, but there's really kind of six in a row here. The prohibition against hating one's brethren, the religious duty to rebuke a fellow Jew for improper behavior, the prohibition against shaming a Jew, the prohibition against taking revenge, the prohibition against bearing a grudge, and the prohibition of affection for a fellow Jew. So those six are kind of a piece, which we'll see the flow over the next 2 weeks, hopefully.
So not the first one.
The first one is really different. It is different, although, yeah, it is different. It's not of that one piece, of that flow. But, of course, yeah, it's where we're at. Okay, so not to stand idly by when someone's blood is shed, that we should not refrain from saving the life of an Israelite when we see him in danger of death and perdition. How do you define perdition? I'm asking you guys. I should have looked it up.
Oh. It's, well, like, tradition. It's like tradition is like sort of
Hellfire and brimstone.
That's. I was going to say my mental image is what we right. Mm-hmm. My mental what? Image is
hell, perdition.
Is like going to right.
Yeah, the collective
visual image of the bad of the bad, the worst that can happen.
Right. Uh huh. So because I looked in the Hebrew to define it, I just didn't look it up in English.
What does this say in the Hebrew?
So it says hamita, which is death, the ha'aveda, loss. Aveda.
Well,
loss. Yeah. Like when we say something, a lost item is returning, the mitzvah of returning a lost item is hashavas aveda. Hashavat aveda. Aveva.
Perdition
aveda.
Is like.
Right. It's a loss of soul.
It's like it's like the worst thing you can imagine.
I don't think it's loss of soul here. I think it's physical.
It's like the worst thing that you can
imagine. I think in this case it's physical.
It is, but your soul is what goes to perdition, not your body.
That's no, so I think
it's a different use of the
word. It's a different use of the word. It's not in the Christian context. We're
but
going to get the definition on.
It's like the worst thing that you can imagine.
I think here it is like physical torture, like not just death. Like death
something
is
worse.
One thing, but being drawn and quartered is another thing. I think that's perdition.
And as it's used here.
Yeah, as it's used here. Because it's one thing to be stabbed, or one thing to be shot, or one thing to be hung.
It's sort of like a torture as opposed to a quick.
I think so. I think that's what this is talking about.
In Christian theology, a state of eternal punishment and damnation into which a sinful and unpenitent person passes after death.
Yeah, but we don't want the Christian one. We want the next one.
Okay, well, utter destruction, obsolete, loss, eternal damnation.
See, loss. You just said loss.
Yeah.
Hell.
It's interesting that he used the word perdition. But aveda is the word that's in Hebrew. Okay, so we have.
Okay.
So we're not allowed to watch somebody go to that.
He's suffering.
If we have the ability to rescue him in some way.
But it says Israelite.
Yes, it does. This mitzvah is for Jews.
So it says someone here, but really someone meaning
Jews. It is, right. So
in that sense, it does fall into the same.
The pasuk is al ta'amod, lo ta'amod al dam re'echa. Right, so just like they have to, the echa kamocha, love your rea, like yourself. So we've defined rea in a few different ways. So rea can mean neighbor, can mean friend. I mean, that's the way it's often translated. But rea, it's the same root as trua, which is the staccato note of the shofar blast. Right, so it can mean broken piece. So here we define it really as broken piece of ourself. So that would be friend or neighbor. Right, a piece of us. So re'echa. We do have a separate halacha to save non-Jews. It's not, I don't believe that it's one of the 613 mitzvot, but it is a halacha that you're not allowed to stand idly by while an unfair killing of a non-Jew is happening either. But that's not one of the 613. This is one of the 613 mitzvot to not stand by.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it's in Leviticus.
Right. Right, all of this is in Kedoshim, the parsha of Kedoshim. We should be holy. Right, so there's a lot of things that are implied by this. You have to try to save somebody. If you see somebody drowning in a river, or a wild beast dragging him off, or bandits coming upon him, that he's duty-bound to save him by his own efforts, if you can, because it says specifically, you shall not stand idly by. I mean, you can't just stand there. You have to proactively go out and do your best. And not only if you can't do it, then you're obligated to hire somebody. Right. Let's say you're a 7-year-old lady walking down the walk and you see bandits coming. So you can hire that little troop of Bukhram, and say, I'll pay you. Go save him. You have to. You can't just say, because there are some mitzvot where you don't have to spend your own money on it necessarily. But this is one where you do. You're obligated to do what you can to save that person. Now, of course, this is not where it's a justifiable death. It's not that you have to jump in the way of the hangman's noose if he was fairly... No, whatever that is, but this is where it's not okay. And it also applies to testimony. If you know something that can save somebody, you have to insert yourself in it. You cannot stay quiet. You have to say something. So it does. So you have to spend your money. So you have to spend your body. You have to spend your money. You have to spend your words. You have to insert yourself in it. And you have to be willing to kill somebody who's chasing also. You're permitted to do that. Somebody who's a rodef, you are allowed to stop them from chasing and killing by actually killing them, which is an interesting concept, and not that I fully understand. But what he's saying is that this law makes sense just in the context of society. So we do have certain laws that are there to make society run well, the reason why it's a mitzvah is so that you get the mitzvah benefit of it. So we know that the Torah is not set up just to help society run well. It is set up to be physical pathways through which we achieve spiritual goals. But it's really, it's one of the blessings that Hashem gave us, that many of the physical pathways that he gave us make society run well. So we would choose to have this rule anyway. Certainly we would choose to have a no murder, no stealing, no adultery, no coveting somebody else's wife kind of a rule in a society anyway. We don't need the Torah to tell us that. It's just that that is the way things should be set up, and if Hashem makes it into a mitzvah, then we get extra spiritual connection by keeping those laws, not just a healthy society. So this way we get healthy society plus transcending soul by keeping these laws. So, but if you don't do it, he says this applies to everybody and every time and every place, male and female, but if you disobey and you refrain from rescuing, you don't get lashes because there was no physical action. You didn't do
something.
Right? You didn't do something to bring the negativity upon you. You refrained from doing something, therefore you don't get whipped by it, but you still were wrong to do it. You'll pay your price, but with a shame.
As opposed to you must do A, this is a failure to do A.
Correct.
As opposed to right. Sort of a distinction.
Right. Now,
distinction.
In general, we have a concept that it's harder to do tshuva for mitzvahs that you didn't do than it is for averas that you did do. Right. Averas that you did do, you created damage. Mm-hmm. And through tshuva, you can shift that damage actually even into a merit. But with mitzvahs that you didn't do, it's a lost opportunity that you can never regain. So you can't get that back. There's no flipping it. Like with an avera, with an actual negative thing, you can flip it into merit. But with a lost opportunity, you can never get it back. So that's this. This would be a lost opportunity.
Like right, because once the guy is injured, he's injured or dead or whatever.
Right. Not like Lashon Hara, because that's an avera.
Right.
So then you've created damage.
Okay.
It's like not benching.
I'm just thinking of something that goes out that you can't put back. You know, you can't.
Right, you can't
really
get back.
It.
No, so not benching is a good example, right? So if you wait 73 minutes after you finished eating, then it's lost, and you can never get that opportunity for benching again.
Right.
It's gone.
Right.
So the opportunity you had for spiritual connection after that meal is permanently lost, never recoverable.
For that particular meal.
Correct.
Right.
Right. But that opportunity for connection is lost.
Right.
It's like seeing somebody in a kiddush and not going over to greet them.
Right.
You will never have
later.
You'll never have that opportunity to strengthen that relationship.
Right.
Again, you will have different opportunities,
right.
But the second time you see them later on, you will have missed that first opportunity, and so you're greeting now somebody that at a lower level of relationship than they would have been had you greeted them before.
Right.
And strengthen the relationship just that much. Then the next time you'd be growing, building on that. But since you didn't, so now you're not, right? So you can't regain lost opportunities, turns out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The prohibition against hating one's brethren. This is also for Jews. You shall not hate your brother in your heart. So it's lo tisna et achicha bil vavecha. So this is not re'echa, but achicha. Shall not hate your brother in your heart. Now, this is interesting because specifically it's bilvavecha, in your heart. That's the isur here. It's a specific negative commandment, and it applies only to hatred that's in your heart. Once you act on it, it's not this transgression, it's a different one. This transgression is holding it in your heart, holding that hatred in your heart. So you're not allowed to do that. Once you act, that could be you're not allowed to take vengeance. Excuse me, or bear any grudge. And you're certainly transgressing the positive of you shall love your neighbor as yourself. But this is a specific negative to not hate your brother in your heart. Right. So obviously this root principle is known also why it should be there, because the hatred in your heart leads to all kinds of negative things. So you don't.
Shemesh.
Right. Right. What is that? So amazing to see. Yeah.
I felt that way about throwing rocks from Mayor Shireen.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, how many people have learned to observe Shabbat because you threw a rock at their car?
My daughter has is living proof of the negative that can result from actions.
Mm-hmm. I heard.
Those that do it, hopefully their thought is, you know, I'm trying to call your attention to this. I don't know that that's the case, however.
you are giving the benefit of the doubt.
Yes. The benefit of the doubt.
Which is a positive commandment.
Yes, it is a positive commandment.
Check one for you. I did hear a nice story about somebody who was there at some kind of a rock-throwing event. Who told us? I think I heard it in Zera Abraham. So maybe it was Rabbi Steinberg who told the story. We have a new rabbi.
He's so nice. He's great to have him.
Anyway, so maybe he told the story about somebody who was actually at a demonstration where rocks were thrown. He was not one of the throwers, but he noted the license plate of the car. And then after Shabbos, he looked it up, and he went to their house to apologize.
On behalf of the community.
And he said, you know, I'm a Shomer Shabbos person, and I just want you to know that not all Shomer Shabbos people are this way, and I want to apologize on behalf of our community for this. So the person accepted the apology, and then, like a week later, called him up and said, you know, I was just wondering, like, where in the neighborhood, we're kind of new in the neighborhood, where in the neighborhood can you get kosher meat? Like, where might we find it? Something. And then, and slowly they created a relationship where they did, this family did become Shomer Shabbos. They were on a little bit of a growth path. But this person created the space for him to have a contact in the Orthodox community that he was able to say, where could I shop? And they invited him over for dinner, and they saw Shabbos, and they did become Shomer Shabbos. So, right, that's really the way.
Much better way to create connections.
Right, right. So we do have to work on the Ahav Yisrael. So I don't believe, however, that being said, that the throwing the rocks is this prohibition. I don't think it's hating your brother in your heart.
Mm,
and
I'm not sure
that Beit Shemesh is either. I think it's foolishness. I think it's ridiculous. I think it's completely errant. I think it's arrogance, for sure. But I'm not sure. I think it is creating a hatred now. But I don't think it was born of hatred. I don't think it was born of hatred. I think on the other side. I think on both sides now.
Maybe.
I think on both sides it's probably creating hatred.
Do you think they look at this next one as the basis for what they're doing?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I do. So that's a good segue. Let's look at that next one. Okay. So the next one, 239.
Seems like that's what this is saying. It is your duty. It's a mitzvah to do this.
Yes, absolutely.
It's a misinterpretation of what this means.
This mitzvah is called Hocheach Tochiach et Amitecha. That is the source of it. Hocheach Tochiach. So you have a double language. The mitzvah to rebuke a fellow Jew for improper behavior. But it's stated doubly. It's not just Hocheach. Not just give a tochacha, but double. So that double language is used sometimes when you'll see in the English where it says, die, you shall surely die, you shall surely. You know, that's because it has a double language, mate you mat, or something like that. So there are times when it's a double verb. So here's one of them.
Say it again.
Chocheach, tochiach. So it's in there, it's the second line in the middle.
Chocheach, tochiach.
I was looking at the beginning, and I was like, I'm not seeing it. That's the pasuk. Shnei Amar is telling you that it's quoting a pasuk now.
Okay.
Chocheach tochiach et amitecha velo tisa alav chet. Okay, so that's the whole verse. You shall reprove your neighbor and not bear sin because of him. So there's a lot of things in that. So one is, if you see your neighbor doing something wrong and you don't correct him, the sin is your fault. Right? So that's number one way of understanding this. There's a few ways of understanding this, so we'll go through a few different ones, right? So way number one, you are to rebuke your neighbor for doing something wrong, and if you don't, the sin is your fault. Okay, that's number one.
That's one way to do it.
That's one way to understand it. Another way to understand it is you shall rebuke. It's your job to rebuke. We don't have policemen who enforce the Torah. It's all of us, right? We are supposed to be one nation, right? You shall rebuke your fellow, but don't bear a sin because of him.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning, don't do it in a way that hurts him, causes him shame, causes him to hate you, right? You could rebuke somebody and do it completely wrong. So,
which is what we have examples of.
Yes, right. So, but that's the next way to understand this, right? You shall surely reprove your neighbor and don't bear a sin because of him, right? So that's causing him,
right?
And now a third way to understand it is, you need to rebuke him in an appropriate way, because you shouldn't bear a sin because of him, not because the sin will be yours, but because you might come to hate him because he's doing that. Right? Because you are actually allowed to hate a sinner if they're a habitual sinner for that sin. You're allowed to do that, but there's so many constraints on that, and you shouldn't be hating the person, right? And you might come to hate the person. So really, you should say something, and especially if they did something against you, right? Don't just say, I'm not saying anything. I'm just never speaking to them again, right? So that's three different ways. Don't bear the sin, you hating them because of it, or you resenting them, or you bearing a grudge. You're not allowed to bear a grudge. That's why I said these are of a piece. Because following this is don't bear a grudge and don't take revenge and love your fellow Jew.
So they're all
right? So you may have problems with those three mitzvahs if you don't rebuke this person. So rebuke the person, don't bear a sin because of
him.
And this
is
even number three.
Somebody you don't know.
Right, right. So that's what, I'm giving you all three, because all three of these are correct.
Interpretations.
Yes, they're all three correct interpretations. Now, one thing I want to say... and I want to find the Rambam to support it, but it says in the Rambam clearly, and this is so important to know in what we're learning, and I'll bring you the Rambam hopefully next week and quote it, but the Rambam says clearly that in halacha we have to pick a way to behave. We have to choose from among the various options. But in thought, we do not. There can be many thoughts that work together, even contradictory, and we can hold by all opinions.
But
so, for instance,
our actions have to be one, right?
We have to pick a way to behave. From that, you have to pick, right? Halacha is how you walk, right? Halacha is Jewish law, but we're sitting at the table discussing theory here. What might this verse mean? Here's one option. Here's two options. Here's three options. Three options for the same verse. And right here, sitting at the table, we can believe all three, and it's fine. But when we get up from the table and walk away, we have to follow the law, right? Halacha. So the question is, which is a separate question, how do we keep this mitzvah? How do we keep it? Not how we think about it. How do we keep it? How do we rebuke or not rebuke? That's separate from what we're discussing right now, which is how do we understand this verse, right? So how do we understand it is different than how do we do it. Right, so the Rambam says understanding, there can be multiple understandings, even contradictory, and they're fine. If they are fine, if they're, as long as there are, you know, strong possibilities with, you know, upheld by positive reasoning for from people who care about their connection with Hashem, then you could have contradictory reasonings and it's okay.
So it's the we're back in a way to the central premise of our actions and behavior.
Right, there's a way that you have to behave. So the question is what? And now that will change. So looking at this, okay, so now do we understand the three ways? Right, it's all rebuke, you shall surely rebuke. It's a strong language. You must rebuke so that you won't bear a sin, right? So the sin could either be, the sin is the three parts, right? So that you won't bear a sin, you won't come to hate the person because, or bear a grudge because they did it. Or so that it won't be your fault that they're sinning. They're doing something that they shouldn't be doing, and it's your job. You know the halacha. You should be telling them. And now, because you witnessed it and you said nothing, their sin falls upon you. You should have said something, right? Or number three, that they will bear the sin, right? That you're
trying to help them.
You're trying to help them. Oh, you rebuke incorrectly, and now you bear their sin because now they have a grudge against you because you did it wrong. Right? Those are the three ways to three of the ways to understand this pasuk. Right? So, but we see in this, it's interesting because the current teaching today is different than what he says here. This is, again, written in the 14th century. So he says you have to go again and again and again. If he doesn't stop, you do it again. How do you know you should do it again? Because it says chocheach tochiach, not just chocheach, right? Not just correct him. Correct him, correct him. He doesn't fix his actions, correct him again. He doesn't fix it, correct him again. You have to be on top of him, correct him again. Right? So that's what he's saying here in the Sefer HaChinuch. It's interesting. Among the laws, there's what the sages of blessed memory said, that the obligation of this precept is until a beating. In other words, the one giving reproof has a duty to increase his rebuke until the sinner comes close to striking the admonisher. So until the sinner comes close. Not that you should beat him, but you should rebuke him until he's about to smack you for the rebukes, until he can't take it anymore.
But that's not the case today.
No. Nevertheless, our sages of blessed memory also said that if the admonisher sees that no useful effect results from the words of his reproof because of the great wickedness of the sinner, or if he is an extremely violent and wicked man, and the other fears him that he may raise up against him and kill him, he is not duty-bound to fulfill this precept for that man. This is why the sages of blessed memory said, just as it is a religious obligation to say something that will be heeded, so is it a religious duty to be still in an instance where the word will not be heeded, because there will be a disgrace for the admonisher and no useful benefit for the man rebuked. Okay. Based on this understanding is the way that we behave today.
The last part.
Yeah. Which is we pretty much don't say much today. We don't really. We understand today that we don't have the type, we don't have the communal level of observance where people would want to hear. A. We don't have the type of relationships that facilitate the hearing, the saying and the hearing. And most importantly, we, our individual selves, are not on the level that we can do this with love and not with condescension.
But this is the part that some of the people in some of those communities don't even
correct.
Read.
Correct.
Let alone understand.
Right. So that's exactly it, is that you are allowed to think different things, but there is a way to behave. The current way to behave is to not. So, and we see, like, even the Chavetz Chaim, so when I say even the Chavetz Chaim, so he was on a very high level, but we're talking in the 1930s. So we're talking about 80 years ago, we were still in the position that we are today. It hasn't gotten better, right? It's worse. Our connections with each other and our communal observance is worse today than it was then in the 1930s. And the way that he rebuked people, and we have famous stories of him crying, or just, you know, somebody brought in their son who wasn't Shomer Shabbos and said, you know, will you speak to my son? And when he came out, he was Shomer Shabbos for his whole life, so the father wanted to know, you know, what did you say, right? He said, I just took his hand in mine, and I said Shabbos, and I cried. And I just said, Shabbos, Shabbos, and he cried. That was the rebuke.
That was enough.
That holy a person could hold the hand of this teenage boy and cry real tears of pain, real. That this child wasn't connecting with Shabbos, and that he was able to communicate that through his hand, that was the rebuke.
And I mean, I heard a story from a friend who is a rabbi who was talking to a teenager about not observing Shabbos and playing a sports activity on that day, and despite hours of conversation, nothing changed.
Correct.
So that's just...
Correct. Right.
That's a perfect example of the opposite.
So that's where... Right. So for today, that's why we hardly engage in this at all. We are taught not to think and rethink and rethink and consult with somebody and then rethink before we offer rebuke about anything. We're not really supposed to. It still is a mitzvah, right? But you should not do something that will distance somebody.
I was going to say it can have a lot more negative consequences than the potential positive.
Right. That was one of the funny things somebody said at the AJAP conference. Somebody asked him, "Oh, are you in Kiruv Rechokim? Rechok is somebody who's far. Kiruv is bringing close. Are you in Kiruv Rechokim?" And he said, "No, I'm in Rechok Krovim. I'm in the distancing of those who are close." Right? So, and some rabbis, unfortunately, are in that, or some people certainly are in that. So throwing rocks or spitting on little girls is for sure Rechok Krovim. I mean, it certainly isn't Kiruv Rechokim, that's for sure. Nobody's becoming firm through that. But there will be people who are in the middle who are repulsed by that and will become distanced thereby.
And even,
that's Rechok Krovim.
And it's really bad sort of in the bigger community as well in terms of how we as Jews are viewed by others.
So that's called,
we do live in that
that's
community.
Called Chil Hashem.
Yeah, yes. And we do live in that
It's
community.
A tremendous Chil Hashem.
It's huge.
It's around the world.
Huh?
It was broadcast.
Well, yes.
And
bad for the Jews.
A bad,
yes, yeah.
I mean, my gosh.
Right. So that's what this is saying. I mean, you shall rebuke them, but don't bear sin because of them. So even if you think rebuke is the thing, so the thing to do is to try to figure out how can you best work on the qualities of tznius in the community. How can you, you know, what efforts can you take? So you look at different efforts. There are people who are making movies about it. There's people who are making groups about it. There's Friday night things for little girls about it. There's all kinds of different tznius efforts that don't involve spitting or rock throwing. that might be more effective.
Especially when a child who is dressed very...
Right.
Properly.
Frankly, even if she's wearing a tank top and shorts.
Right. But I mean...
There's no room for that at all whatsoever.
You should really look the other way. I mean...
Right. Yeah, don't look.
They have no right. They have no right.
Don't look.
Right. Not acceptable.
If they're looking at it, makes you question what exactly are they looking at.
Right, for sure. Mm-hmm. Right. So, and Judaism is not like other religions that, I mean, not, I won't name them, but it is actually the man's responsibility, not the woman's responsibility. Mm-hmm. So the woman is responsible.
For herself.
But she's, and frankly, we are all responsible for the environment that we create. You know, Rabbi Rieti likes to point out that our faces don't belong to us. You know, we have control over them. But my face is really in your domain, mm-hmm. right? So I have no right to walk around with a sour expression because I'm polluting your environment.
I like that.
Right? It's my job to walk around with a smile because my face is for you.
You don't see it.
I don't see it, right? It's not part of my environment.
Sort of
part
like
of
painting your house bright pink. You don't really look at it. It's your neighbor's.
Right. So I have a responsibility to you for the environment, for your environment that I am taking part in creating. Now, that's not just my face. Mm-hmm. That is how I dress also, right? So not to say it's wrong to wear fur at all, but I chose not to. When my grandmother offered me her fur and told me she would restyle it for me, because it was older, I told her I can't wear a fur. I didn't live in a cold enough place that I needed it, but I said, I don't want to be part of creating it, even though the animals were dead, right, already. I wasn't causing. But I felt that wearing it helped create a market for furs, and I didn't want to wear it that I'm creating an environment in which furs are desired. It's just part of, and again, it's fine. Anybody wants to wear fur is fine. I just chose at that time that I didn't want to be part of that market. Then I don't want to add to that. But that's part of it. We do by what we wear, by we create a market for ideas, for mm-hmm. fashion, for all that stuff. So yes, we do have to take responsibility for that. We don't have to take responsibility for men staring at us and oogling us. We don't. That's not our job. However,
but
we do have to take responsibility and think about what are we wearing? How are we contributing to the environment of people around us? How do we portray women? How do we portray Jewish women? How do we portray, you know, what sense of honor am I showing to others? Right? So it's subjective. There's an objective standard, but there's also a very subjective standard, right? So what I'm wearing is fine right here and right now, but if I was in 1880s, even America
now would be very
completely inappropriate in all
legs.
Circles.
I can see your legs.
Right? So
and your arms and your
right. And
hands.
Frankly, if I would wear that 1880s dress right now, also completely inappropriate. I'd be turning
right.
heads. I'm not right to go to King Super shopping in a hoop dress. You know, like besides, I'd be pulling things over as I walked to the aisle. But
you probably couldn't even get in your car.
But I'd be turning heads like crazy. It would be totally inappropriate, even though objectively I'm completely covered. Subjectively, it's not modest because it makes a point of my physicality. Mm-hmm. Right. So, okay. So let's see here. Should we go? I think we should probably stop here. So how do we do this today? Let's just close a little bit. So if we do feel that we want to rebuke a fellow Jew, it has to come from a place of total love. Consider again. Discuss with somebody else to make sure that your approach is correct. It's not coming from a place of anger. It's not coming from a place of condescension, but that you do want to share something with love and review with somebody else before you share it with them, if that might be the right way, and if it will have a toelet, if it will have a positive, constructive end. If it's really risky, it shouldn't be shared. If you really think it's 50-50, maybe they'll hear it, maybe they won't. No, then don't share it because you could create more damage than you're fixing. So we don't do that. We could try to set a proper example, you know, but in front of them. Like, let's say you see somebody chopping salads on Shabbos in two small pieces, but you don't want to tell them, right? So you might, you know, bring over an Israeli salad to their house the next Shabbos and say, oh, I brought you a salad, and, you know, and I was learning with Rabbi Fleischer about the pieces, so you don't have to worry at all. I took extra care to make sure the pieces were big enough. You know, so you could, like, offer, like, that kind of thing, like, in the back door, maybe. Mm-hmm. I hope that's a fire drill and not an actual fire.
I'm sure it is a fire drill,
okay.
But, I mean, I don't know for sure, but...
Right. Anyway, so this is a mitzvah, and we are extremely careful with it. It should come from a place of love and construct, not destruct, to create relationships and not destroy them.
Yes,
Thank you. Okay.
Thank you.